about 2 pages of notes, and I'm going to just try to – these are all just working impressions of what this reading was about to me. I was talking to Jeffrey that a theme in reading this is I was doing a lot of feeling the sensations around the words. I want to bring that into the way I was processing this. So first off, you know, Bateson starts off with using a sight metaphor around propositions of seeing how the conference, you know, you see me, but you don't really see me. You know, you make you make hypotheses of what you're seeing of me. And he goes into, you know, breaking that out and questioning that, and how from those propositions, there's assumptions. And if I feel he's turning it into, just getting down to the nitty gritty, it's about information and how we get information about others around the world and what sort of stuff is information. He's very much working from the point of view of this experience of information. And how from that experience there are errors that we make in the way we organize the information. But he quickly, or not so quickly, but he makes a point of trying to pull out the intangible nature of the epistemological error. It's kind of, you know, we don't even know we're making it, in a sense, that we're making these errors. And so he's breaking down how that process is happening, or how he sees that process from his point of view of taking place. And it all comes around to a core thing that I found in the piece, a new way of thinking about what a mind is. And then he lists minimal characteristics of a system as characteristics of a mind. So he is bringing a model of information theory about a mind and the complexity around that, and how that this complexity he's really showing that it's in our own heads, but he also is pointing to the fact that it's outside our heads. It's not just inside our heads. It's in the environment. It's in how other things are processing information, you know, like plants or other forces. One of the things in the characteristics, he lists 4 characteristics. And the one that I found interesting is, because in the listening of characteristics, he's trying to bring out that there is a self-correctiveness in the direction of homeostasis and or in the direction of runaway. So I feel he's really trying to show that even though there are pathological errors, and he also makes the point that they work to a certain extent until we end up experiencing some kind of massive trouble. You know, they reach their limit. So he brings in the notion of self-correctingness implies trial and error. So with that, I think what he's trying to do is with trial and error is when we're faced with the experience of trouble, of our errors, then we have to turn back, or we apply a trial. What's going on? A self-correctiveness. One of the pieces that I found interesting for me of understanding that I really liked, and probably the thing I got out of reading his book, Mind and Nature, a Necessary Unity, which I read that one first before I've read this one, and I read that one back in the 70s, is challenging the notion of the old Darwinian notion of natural selection, of evolution, of being the unit of survival is the family line, genetics, species, subspecies. And from bitter experience, that the unit of selection is organism plus environment. That's what he's trying to bring forward, is of enlarging the unit of survival of not just genetics or species or family line. Now I'm going to jump to Nora, and I'm going to read something from Parts and Whole that influenced me in reading this this whole thing. Being able to see systems requires the observer to muster the muscle to hold multiple inputs and outputs in mind simultaneously, while recognizing that the action of this observing itself is within the clump of interactions in process. As we are taught by second order cybernetics. And then the last piece I'm going to bring up with Nora that was the most difficult, as Jeffrey and I were saying, the most difficult really to digest. But I'm going to read a definition that she put out, or of semimathesy. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. A new word for system refers to living systems which emerge from communications and interactions of interdependency, and particularly mutual learning, and she with that, she's challenging the Parts and Whole of mechanistic parameters that can't hold when there's variables of interactions. There's limitations to the engineering and mechanism model. And so she's trying to use language to change our descriptions, so that if I get this is a feeling, not a direct understanding, by changing the description and using language to change a description, it can influence and enlarge or affect our view, our perspective. So that, I feel, is very tied to the power of language as a whole. And she wants the language to be more relational rather than mechanical and Parts and Whole. But the last thing I'm going to say is I've been spending a lot of time around this that she brought up, and I didn't realize that it was it's just funny. It's one of those things that got into my unconscious, and then over the last week or so through the cafes and coming across cardinal hermeneutics, this falls right into place with this little piece I'm going to read. The skin of my body provides what looks like a boundary around me, but I extend well beyond the container of my flesh, both biologically and socially. Very, 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 I felt like I was in a beautiful garden, and I was just overwhelmed at times of the the variety of what was being put forth through the language of both Gregory and Nora. And I really appreciated it, but I'm not sure I understand all of it, but I feel very, very different in a very healthy, good way by reading this piece.
And a beautiful garden, overwhelmed and very different and healthy, I believe you said.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else about healthy?
Yeah, to riff off the very word, it's just, I feel enlarged. I feel invigorated, like visiting the Grand Canyon or someplace.
Like visiting the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, it's got that dual nature that it's kind of just wondrous, but when you hold the tension of being in wonder and also feeling so small, that tension is very interesting for me because I've learned to hold it and be grateful for it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I love that idea of holding these things in one's, maybe not even one's mind, but somehow one holds them in one's body as well as one's mind.
I mean, oh, that's a very good, yes, Gregory, I'm glad you deepened that. That's true.
Jeffrey, his name is Jeffrey.
Yeah, Gregory is fine.
I'm sorry, Jeffrey.
The association.
I have a name glitch in my head. I have to keep working with. I don't know if that's mechanical or organic.
Definitely organic.
I think the challenge is when it's that dilemma about it, is it the mind or the body is the source of this, and how we figure that out. I was reading something in the New York Times. I want to quote. I read this yesterday. New York lawmakers have agreed to pass a sweeping climate plan that calls for the state to all but eliminate its greenhouse emissions by 2050, envisioning an era when gas-guzzling cars, oil-burning heaters and furnaces would be phased out, and all of the state's electricity would come from carbon-free sources. If the state manages to hit these targets, it would effectively, I'm gonna start crying. It would effectively create a so-called net zero economy, the ultimate goal of environmentalists and others seeking to slow the pace of global warming. New York's bill would set one of the most ambitious climate targets by a legislator anywhere in the world. Well, it just affects me. I've worked 30 years on this. And so did Bateson, both Gregory and Nora, and many, many, many people around the world. So for me, I know this is just a first step in what will be a bloody, bloody confrontation with an opposition which is ruthless. So I am not being romantic here, but it is a first step. And then there will be a second step and a step after that. And we can't make a plan. However, there will be opportunities that will open up because we are willing to create conditions for that to happen. So you're going to see spontaneous eruptions, such as happened in Hong Kong when 2 million people showed up to protest the interference of Beijing in their judicial process. And you see a young man who was arrested in a riot. The Beijing called this 2 million people gathering a riot. And they arrested people. You see one of the young men who was arrested come out. He's released because of the pressure that has been put on Beijing. And he stands there in front of the crowd and says, "The world is watching." And it's so heartbreaking. Because I just see the young people coming forward with this incredible bravery. And they and I feel like, okay, what's up ahead is so enormously complex. But I just see that and I'm just touched, because I know that those persons in Hong Kong who are marching and demonstrating and turning out, showing Beijing, we're paying attention to this. The world is paying attention. So I think, and also the Gay Pride March, which is happening in a week here in Manhattan, which will turn out millions of people. And I mentioned earlier that I was at one of the first marches, Gay Pride marches in the 70s, and there are about 2,000 people who showed up. And we were, we were attacked, pelted by garbage. People were insulting us. So I'm just saying, if enough of us show up with an intention and a desire, a strong desire, and this desire is not coming out of the theory, it's coming out of something in the body that has a demand. And if enough people can register that and we can create directions that are different from the path dependency of the gross national product, fossil fuels, all of which we know do not work and are leading us quickly towards disaster. But in the name of some pseudo-realism, we continue to pay homage to these, what I think Bateson's calling very ad hoc maneuvers that have been made in the past. And we're paying homage constantly to these our path dependencies. Anyway, I think it's a mix of theory and the somatic intelligence. We do need adequate theory, and we do need the interplay of the theoretical and the cognitive capacities and these I consider much vaster somatic intelligences that we ride upon. And I say I because that personal pronoun I is a very slippery notion, and it seems to be quite promiscuous because it depends on which world I'm in. Because if I'm in a dream state or I'm in a deep meditation, or that I is in a conference room using a voice to articulate perhaps something that's vague and unclear but is deeply felt, these are very different kinds of that personal pronoun is what kind of agency goes along with that personal pronoun. So I think this is what both Nora is hyper aware of, and I believe what Gregory was aware of. And I'm so moved by his valiant attempt to deal with these inarticulate spaces that he tried to flesh out. And I think he did. I think there's a lot that's exaggerated and not quite there yet. But I can't help but be moved because, in a sense, we are from his future. And he was, I think, expressing the potential that many of us are continuing to want to hold and embrace and accept the enormous ambiguities that are in our social, complex social and metaphorical landscapes. So I'm just sharing that with you guys because I did not know. I guess I'm very jaded and cynical in many ways, but I found this so such good news. Yeah. And it's a, like I said, it's just a baby step. And there's absolutely no guarantee that it's going to work. Constant vigilance will be necessary. But I do sense that there is an intergenerational effort being made. And those of us who are tired and weary, and I am, believe me, I'm very tired. But I feel like I can, there's some there, I can pass the baton. I was at a grocery store the other day. I was feeling so tired and very grumpy, actually, by all the mindless behavior of the people that are around me and my own duplicity and collusion in that mindlessness. And I saw such rude behavior and being expressed right in front of me as I tried to get into the line, a very long line, with my groceries. And I just saw, as others saw that I was trying to step into the line, they were cutting in front of me. And I just like, okay, people, to do what you have to do. But a young man who was coming forward with his groceries, he saw this perplexity. And he made a gesture like, please, take your place in line and I will be behind you. He made this as a gesture. I went, no, after you. Because he makes a kind gesture, I feel compelled to do the same thing rather than knock people down with my elbows and say, get out of my fucking way. Which is what everybody basically was nonverbally doing with me, but they were definitely pushing me out of the way. And so he was in front of me and I was behind him and I mumbled something like, okay, that's my good deed for the day. And he turned and he struck up a conversation with me. And it made the long wait to get to the register quite pleasurable because he was, we started talking about technology and we started talking about the use of smartphones and the use of flat screens. And he was alerted. He's 21 years old, but he's extremely alerted to all of the warnings that we have talked about here in many of our conferences and our calls about the dangers of flat screens. Maybe last year we had that with the Jordan Brown, that demonstration. I mean, the documentary he did on flat screens and all the information that we have about how dangerous this is, especially with young, young nervous systems being exposed to this and how it flattens the affective zones and communication capacities when used in addictive ways. But this young man just gave me so much information about that, those addictive patterns, how he had recognized it in his own behavior, how he has alerted his social circle about the use of the misuse of these smartphones, so-called smartphones. And I think he initiated practice, and I've heard others have used this too, where they go out socially, everyone puts their smartphone in the center of the table, and whoever feels the need to use their smartphone pays the bill. And that has interrupted the pattern. So instead of everyone grabbing for their smartphones and checking their email and disrupting the rapport with the others that they're with, there's a, I don't have to do this. what is so important about my checking my emails. Because he noticed he found out through an app that he was checking his emails 500 times a day.
Wow.
He was able to register. He was using it 4 hours a day. He was online. And now he's reduced his online communication to 1.5 hours, which is a big reduction. He wants it to go lower than that. But he's when he gets a text message from a nephew of his who's 14, he's 21, he lectures his nephew. He says, "What are you doing texting me? You should be out playing." And I'm just saying, wisdom from the mouth of babes. I wish I was so adept as he is at monitoring the addiction that these so-called devices use us and manipulate us, and I think have disrupted our capacity for getting to deep rapport with others. Not that it was ever easy. It's never been easy to get rapport with others or to enter into the zone with others. It's much more hard. It's much more difficult now, it seems to me, than ever before. But there are signs. And I definitely believe this young man's conversation with me and his sweetness, his kindness. It just made me feel really good.
Good. That's good, John.
So I think we have hope. We have something to hope for. You know, we're moving towards something besides all of us just arm in arm moving towards a cliff that we're all going to jump off of, like this mass suicide.
I'm not jumping off. Hell, you know, I'm not jumping off. I think this ties into both Gregory and Nora trying to bring up. We do have self-corrective capacities. And they were bringing forward this self-corrective part of us that until then maybe wasn't, I don't know how to express it, but especially Gregory was in his work was trying to point out there is a self-corrective if we understand it's not just about the unit of survival of even our own being or our own tribe, but and you've even quoted this, John, you're not going to even live if you don't have an environment. It's like you want a home, you better take care of it, you know? And even Nora, towards the end of, I'm not sure where it was at, but towards the end, because both of them are trying to bring online the learning to learn, learning to learn. That's self-corrective in itself. And she made a point that I liked of turning it back. Even pathology is learning to learn. If we know how to frame it, if we share from different, be open to other perspectives, it probably could, you know, I've been shaken up by people metaphorically slapping me on the side of the head. Getting stuck in patterns. And we've all probably, I'm making an assumption, we all have been surrounded by people we care about that have gone down the addictive habitual road and have a care that is so entangled in trying to help them that we've had to step away because it can be very toxic to our care. Enabled in an unhealthy way. There's healthy ways to enable, but we have to look at how we're enabling them in a negative way. Like I had to do with my own brother who had addictive personality, the way I had to deal with my own father that was diagnosed with manic depressive. Any number of things of even me being part of their condition. Just me being part of their condition, it rubs off.
Yeah, I picked up on the same thing, Michael, about this pathologies being an opportunity for learning or interaction with. I picked that out. As well as being a very strong statement. Although I do think that Nora Bateson's arguments take Gregory Bateson's ideas forward into a different kind of thing. Yes. So where Gregory is talking about self-corrected behaviors, which we fully understand as part of the basic mechanisms of these semathetics. But Norris is talking about this idea of contextualized learning. And I think contextualized learning is a broader concept that includes self-corrective, but includes other elements. Co-adaptive, I talked about co-adaptive before Johnny came on, which is the term I've been using for these kinds of things before I read this text by Nora. I have to say that when I read this text, I read Nora Bateson's, the whole book, I've read it from the point of view of somebody who's reading an interesting book, and I'm learning a lot from it, but there's a kind of a separation between me and her when I'm reading it. You know, I think of, oh, she's an expert. She's, you know, she's done all this heavy thinking, but I don't know Nora Bateson, you know?
Right.
And I have to admit that when I read this text on Semethi, which is close to some of my own ideas, I sort of started to think, because she also talks about her institute, the International Bateson Institute, which I guess is in Sweden. And I was thinking, gee, maybe I could apply to go and work there.
Cool.
Because now I kind of see what she's saying intersects with some of my own thinking in ways that I want to move beyond this reading a book.
Oh, that's fascinating.
More engaging with her and some of these ideas, because she says how Gregory Bateson's ideas have molded her. But as I've said several times over the course of this discussion, for me, Gregory Bateson, I read him at the beginning of my career. And my whole career has been structured in some ways by Gregory Bateson's ideas. So I sort of feel I also have this kind of privileged relationship, if you like, with some of these ideas, and that maybe it would be interesting to go. And also because Nora Bateson moves the discussion from the intellectual sphere into the artistic sphere again.
Oh, yeah.
She does that again very strongly here. And, of course, in my own work, the arts have taken a larger and larger role in this context. And in my own work, I'm shifting from the purely intellectual mode into something that's much more complete on the artistic and scientific sides as well. So I feel that there's a kind of resonance.
Aaron Manning's Sense Lab is very similar to what you would imagine the International Batesonian Institute.
Maybe I could just pop down the road, but
no, I think he wants to be around Nora.
I think you want a pilgrimage, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I do. Right. I do.
Right.
If it's around the block from you, it's no big deal. But if it's across the world and on a mountaintop, well, that's much more interesting.
Yeah.
I relate to that.
I think this is part of what's coming up is I read Mind and Nature, A Necessary Unity, which my understanding, Jeffrey, that was kind of a condensed version of Steps.
In a way, it was written later, and he synthesized a lot of the work in Steps and wrote it for a public in an integrated way, right? As opposed to Steps, which is a series of papers from different texts, right?
Okay. So, well, what I'm finding is I read that book back in 1980. And, you know, I I'm just going to make another assumption that all of us maybe have read certain books that later down the line, well, and you've said it about Bateson as far as the start of your career, but that book, Mind and Nature, just the title as a necessary unit, that metaphor has been in my unconscious ever since then. Everything I've come across is, now I can see how much that metaphor has been operating in some way. And it, I just find that fascinating, you know? I find that fascinating. And I found a little phrase that he said that, and I need your help to understand this, is a difference is an idea. When he was,
it was this argument about difference isn't spatially located, which is I think very interesting because.
Okay.
Although I have to say that in my field of professional study, which is geomatics, we make maps of differences. So it's not quite true that you can't localize distance. Difference. Okay. You can take one map and subtract another map, and you get a localization of difference. But that said, the idea is that difference is really an abstract concept rather than a tangible thing that you can locate, right? So
yeah, because he was tying that to the Young paper of the differences of Pothorma and creature.
Yes.
He tied it to that as Pothorma and the Young
Pleroma.
Of just
Pleroma.
forces and impacts. And when you have creature, that's when differences actually show up. Am I right in understanding that?
Yeah. And then he has this idea that he has in this text that what is a, what he calls a system, what Nora calls a semath.
Yeah,
semathesy.
I think it's semathesy, isn't it?
Semathesy is this idea that it's a difference propagates through the circuits in this thing. So there again, the difference isn't located in any particular place in the system. It moves through the system, right?
So
yeah. That's how the information gets around. Difference that moves and drives things, right?
Okay.
Is that your understanding, Johnny?
Could you repeat that? I was writing something down.
So it's this idea that the difference moves through the system, that it drives that drives information. I think you have a very grounded understanding of the difference that makes a difference.
Yeah, this is his picture, and he's talking to I think it's some legislators in Hawaii. He's talking about DDT.
Yeah.
And I think he gives this diagram with circles, which is something that Nora is wanting to move beyond.
Mm.
I think she thinks this is oversimplifying and maybe even distorting something. I think these are necessary, but not sufficient, I think. I think she's doing something. He was dealing with first order systems and moving out of that
to second order.
I think
she's moving to the next level. But
she's third order. Yeah.
But Johnny, when you do your diagrams, right, with you do diagrams with circles and arrows and different things. But your diagrams are always a bit artistic. So they have a little bit of so they're not pure scientific, you know, there's a kind of emotional feeling that your diagrams carry. And so I think that's interesting in this context.
Well, I also use, I don't use PowerPoint. I use drawings. I want people to get out the crayons. They can get out of their chairs and on the floor if they want. And I want them to start to scribble. And then let's see what happens next.
Right.
I don't want to say create a work of art because that will freak out everybody.
Yeah.
Too much pressure.
I say just represent this experience you've just had in a way that makes sense to you. And strangely enough, that can come out in however way they want it to. sometimes it's images, and sometimes it's squiggles, and sometimes it's odd shapes, and then put that, then show that to the group, then you can have a verbally another description. So we're getting multiple descriptions. It's a very Batesonian idea. And I think you're engaging more of your sensory systems than if you're just sitting back and operating from the neck up, which is what most of us are doing on these flat screens. And I think this is the what I find the charm of what happens is when we then, I have my picture, you have your picture, you have your picture in a way that makes sense to you, but ironically, oddly enough, it makes sense to me too.
Yeah, right.
And we're sharing a reality now that we did not have before we went through this very simple exercise.
Yeah, so, and it's visual as opposed to, because this is the other thing is, although I love words, and obviously I write, you write as well, Johnny, and Michael maybe as well, and Doug. We all write, and the words have a lot of power, and we understand that. But part of the expression that needs to happen, the exchange, the information transfer needs to happen outside of the words. And so the visual form, it's one of the reasons I'm working. I'm coming up for retirement, and I'm in the process of I've decided to put together two new fashion collections for next year, because fashion clothes is not, it's not just visual, it's also visceral.
Yes,
and,
right.
And so it speaks, and it speaks to the body. The clothes, it's hard to find something that is more body based than clothing, you know. So I think that we need at least some of the time to be working outside of the world of words,
right,
in doing this work, right?
Yeah, that's why I was fascinated with Richard Carney, because he has a book called Carnal Hermeneutics, and he's very much into trying to understand that we've forsaken touch and taste. And this is my brief understanding, so I'm not gonna say I have it complete, but I like the feel of what he's trying to bring back is touch is not a organ, it's a medium. And touch is, according to Aristotle, is actually one that overlaps in all the senses.
That's right.
All the senses. And so he brings another layer of depth perspective to the somatic that I've been working with, and understanding that how much sensation itself is mediating. We're always mediating through sensation. And the more we can get better at it or understand and accept it, because sensation has been, in some respects, needed to step back and kind of get perspective and look at, I think that's what Bateson is kind of looking at, how our sensations can get organized in very, you know, mistaken ways. But that's mistaken ways. What we're doing when we, and listening to you go about bringing visual, like you say, Jeffrey, I like it because I'm being touched. In a, my scene is touching.
That's right.
Versus the written word.
That's lovely.
I just want to add something, that when I make a sketch and I show it to you, I made the sketch with my hands.
Yes, yes. Yes.
When I show that to you, you see all that movement.
Yes.
Respond to it kinesthetically. And you're listening to words at the same time. So it's a multi-sensory display of something.
Very good, yeah.
I believe beyond our senses, and includes our senses, because I think we have more senses than the basic five. And that, I believe, is this is an exercise in developing that multisensory, extrasensory perception. And when you do this in a group, as we've done here on occasion, I think we can start to realize a depth perception. And,
yes.
And that sense of touch that you're talking about, which is a medium, touch as a medium, I say yes, there is a non-kinesthetic touch. Mm-hmm. And it also comes through our voices.
Yes.
Voices tell us what's going on in our bodies. It's not something we put into words easily, but we know when we hear a singer or an actor or a friend what kind of state they're in, whether they're feeling healthy or sick or tired or uplifted. There's something that's happening. And I think these are those analogical communiques that both Nora and Gregory was certainly a pioneer in pointing this out, that carries most of our important information that we share with it's not going to be in the auditory digital system. But I think that if we are connecting to language in a certain way, in a full-bodied way, we can reach people beyond our voices. So we have the written word, and we can read the written word of people who lived and died centuries ago.
Oh, very, very.
Still with us.
I totally agree, John. I totally agree.
That, I think, is a kind of telepathy that happens through certain kinds of uses of language. So I say, let's use all of it. Let's use all of it and use all of it well, because we're going to need all of it. We can't just specialize in one area and chop up our experience and become specialized in one area, ignoring and neglecting the others. And this is where I think she's moving forward with this trans-contextual learning.
Yeah, I think this is the way I'm going to put it, is through my work with my own trauma, I've began to own and sort out and define for myself how am I relating to my senses, rather than how I've been told to relate, which may have merit, but a lot of times they're limited. And also, if I buy into an outside version of how to relate to my senses, I'm disconnected by working with how my senses are multisensory, grounding that so I can go beyond, like you're saying. It's like, you know, sometimes, like I said the other day, sometimes we have to go down to go out.
That's
right. It's not that I have to totally leave my head behind. But what, because Richard makes a point that it's hermeneutics all the way down and up, and it's from head to toe and back again. It's head to toe and back again. It's a and this feels like Bateson of circuit, of working with the differences in the circuit.
That's well,
what I feel that
this one and this one.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right.
You can dance this. You got to get up and dance to do this.
well, and of course, the differences that are moving from Michael to Johnny to Jeffrey to back again. So
exactly.
That's also a circuit that's going on here, right?
Now, but the circuits, I'm sorry to interrupt you guys. The circuit, I want to add another layer of metaphor, is fucking entangled sometimes.
That's right. It's much more like a bowl of spaghetti than it is like Doug, I haven't heard from you in a while. Do you want to chime in?
Yeah, Doug.
To you?
Finding the appropriate gap. And thank you. There's quite a bit to say. So I'll start with the body or the non-body or the circuits. Another way to phrase it for some is chakras. Mm-hmm. And just like clothes with the body, with words, I still like to be grounded in myself, and myself, my mind, my thoughts tend towards this removal or temporary placement over on the shelf so I can explore what's really here. and something like the chakras. Yeah, I can experience it, I can feel it, but what about right now in my hand? I can imagine a little person right here with the 7 or 8 chakras, and I can feel that. I can feel it over there, and I can feel it at the same time right in my own body. I can do it with 2 hands. I can, not right now I'm shooting this energy over to wherever you guys might be here on my screen, but maybe you're feeling that right now because I described it. John talked, or we talked about John's drawings and the difference between what's in the book, which I have a free online version of the book, which doesn't put it in there, so I didn't get to see it originally, so I'm glad it was placed there. But that kind of mechanical drawing in a way, or pre-planned PowerPoint type of presentation versus the moment type of drawing. So John's drawing was not pre-planned. It was not something he said, well, okay, I'm going to come into this conversation and make this drawing. It was manifested, it was incarnated. And that goes back to the flesh, the body. And we've talked about how Nora Bateson takes Gregory's ideas forward and kind of into the co-adaptive field, I guess is what Jeffrey was talking about. I keep wanting to call you Gregory now.
Yeah. Well, we could call Gregory Jeffrey Bateson.
I liked something that reminded me of the paper we did on your paper on subversive pedagogies.
Oh yeah.
He talks about in the differences of pathologies or whatever the title is, when later on, I think on the 3rd or 4th page, or he says, well, look what we're doing right here in the academic setting. It's ingrained in your brain that you're going to look at me monologuing, standing in front of you, standing while you sit and you listen to these ideas. So he's saying, relating this to power, I think, or translating our differences and the differences that make a difference into presentation, into power, and the way that we're structured to see things. Even he's in the midst of it, and he's saying, well, what I'm saying here is nonsense. The piece of thinking that I'm putting into you is really just nonsense to a certain extent. But then he goes on to say, well, this is what we're doing all the time. We're in these frames, these references. And it's going back to, we talked about addiction. Jeffrey Bateson has talked about addiction.
Yeah.
And it's not the typical, of course, with his mind, he looked at it a different way of addiction. It's not simply, well, I eat too much or I drink too much. There's so many layers of the addiction, and he takes it into the ecological level of we're addicted to this point of view, the capitalistic this or that, or even when John was so proud of the younger generation that's moving towards this motion. We have to, Nora Bateson would want to say, well, let's be careful where this goes, because we can become addicted to the path of only saving the environment. And well, maybe it's a good thing if humans don't function as well or die out or something like that because we save the environment. But there's still work to be done. But it's a great first step that's needed, and it's dismantling old addictions. And we have to remind ourselves to not get caught in these addictive cycles. And a few other things I wanted to say, but I think before the call, or before Michael did his introduction, Jeffrey was talking about, yeah, it is difficult, like Psammathotsy, the way she tried to put it together, as opposed to the rest of the book, it was more poetic, artistic, a different word choice. But when she actually explains her process, there's something lost in the midst. While at the same time, it's good that she did it, it's there. But when we go back and reread it, we're going to pick up on new things, just like she mentioned in filmmaking in the tide pools. She mentions, well, when I was doing the documentary, I wanted to make a documentary about my father. I wanted to get that essence there. And as she went through, it didn't match exactly how she imagined it, but it led her into new territory in which perhaps the essence of the thing shine through.
I wanted to pick up on something you just did. And I want to connect it to the text as well. She's having trouble with circles. And she says in this section, more than circular. The model of circles is not enough. The cybernetic notion of circular communication, interaction, and cyclical behavior was a big step forward from pre-cybernetic linear descriptions of these processes. The value of that progress in our thinking is not to be underestimated, because conceptual models provide potent impressions to our comprehension. Metaphors matter. While circles are a popular visual metaphor for life, the limits of the circle as a metaphor are overcome in the concept of Psammathotsy. The notion of a Psammathotsy and a learning context within other contexts does not define a two-dimensional field of variables, nor does it return to where it began. A better visual might be the double helix, as the model of learning system must have at least three dimensions, or four if you count time. She goes on to develop that, and I say, well, what about a Klein model? I think that's much more interesting than a double helix. But I also was listening to and watching Doug, and he made a gesture. I don't remember which hand it is. I think it's your right hand. It was that hand, that one, okay. And you said you saw an image of a figure and a chakra system, and you could sense that it was out there in your hand, and it was inside. Did I get that right? Sort of? Yeah. So I'm now, to me, that's interesting. I've never seen or heard anyone do that before in my entire life. You're the first one, Doug. And I just want to point this out. We are doing this all the time. Something novel, innovative. No one's ever done this before. But because no one's ever done it before, no one pays attention to it. And I want to pay attention, or give attention, excuse my language. Trying to retrain myself not to use economic metaphors when I'm applying it to attention. But that's, I believe, much more like dance and art than it is like a concept that's frozen. And I believe it's very fluid, and we're making all these new ideas all the time, and they're coming through us. Yeah, I think it's very perplexing for a lot of us, because we don't know what to do with all this information. We don't know how to organize it, and especially if we're addicted to circles and Venn diagrams, which I am. I love Venn diagrams. But I also recognize that we need more than, but I think the circle and the need for circles and for making circles, and of course in, you know, sacred geometry have mandalas, very elaborate mandalas. I think there's a need for a container, which is very primary. And what's inside and what's outside of a container, it drives our conceptual lives. And I think more recent research done in cognitive linguistics by Mark Johnson and Lakoff and Johnson, they really point this out, how we can't figure out anything, it seems, unless we know what's inside and what's outside. And it's such a primary experience of being inside our mother's womb and then being outside. And that's, and then we're inside, and you can hear it in our language. I'm inside, I'm in love, I'm out of love, I'm out of love. I'm in the loop, I'm out of the loop. So the in and the out is extremely is primary for us. And so I think this addiction to that in, what's in and out, is perhaps pre-cybernetic and early cybernetics, but I think now we're getting so complex that we need to recognize that primary need to organize around, you know, little bubbles within bubbles and next to bubbles into something that may be a little more interactive. So it's not in me or outside of me or in you or outside of you, but it's something that's intraactive between us simultaneously, rather than you send a message to me, I send a message to you, we decode the message and we relay it back through this kind of narrow conduit, which is what early information theory was all about. It was about eliminating noise and getting the signal right. And that is not what I think we're doing now. I think we're doing something infinitely more complex. And then just a pair of one last quote from her. I think she says it just right. It seems to me the ultimate act of love is to allow ourselves and others to be complex. In affection and respect, I try never to pin down, sum up, pigeonhole, label, or otherwise reduce myself or any other living system to a singular tag. So just a little gesture that Doug was making and using his imagination in the way that he did, I feel like that is a privilege, an aesthetic pleasure to be able to enter into the weave of that imaginal space with him and accept, you know, this is very complex. He's very complex. We're in a very complex interplay here, and I can't figure it out ahead of time. I don't know where it's going to go, but I think just giving my attention and sharing our attention, we are able to influence one another, not control, but influence each other in ways that are very deeply respectful. And so I think this is an enjoyable episode and a creative one, rather than some dry, pedantic, fear-based need to solve a problem that I've already decided I'm going to solve this problem. And at the level of the problem, I'll try to seek a solution, which dooms us perpetually to these cul-de-sacs we find ourselves in, rather than going for, well, what do I really want? What do I really desire? Which is often very different from what I think I'm going to get.
Jeffrey, did you want to make a comment?
I just wanted to say, because about the in-out thing, I totally agree with you, Johnny. One of the nice things about the in-out thing is it's not about parts and wholes. In fact, you can't really apply. You can say in versus the total environment versus out, but you can't call in and out. They're not parts exactly. They're closer to Nora Bateson's idea of an interface. Right, so there's an interface between an in and out, which is not that easy to define, right? So I like this way because I think it's a kind of a way of sidestepping part whole dichotomy kind of thinking. So I really like that.
Yeah, this has really activated my imagination. Going back to Kearney, one thing that he gave three connotations for sense. Sense as in sensation, sense in terms of meaning, and then sense in terms of orientation, which, John, you've even pointed to that's one of the first, you know, things that come online even in the womb, if I understand and remember what you were commenting on.
I think, wasn't I talking about the vestibular system? The inner ear orients us in space.
But orientation, he just, orientation. So sense He gave three breakouts: sensation, meaning. This is in terms of his carnal hermeneutics. And then orientation, which I find very, those three ways of working with the word, very helpful to me. Because in looking at what I was listening to in terms of in and out and using what you were saying about in and out and then Doug, I was being activated imagining is I like the in and out, but using my sensation, that interface, that boundary that may be put up by us, how dense, how porous is it? And this is what Kearney's trying to say. The flesh is a medium, not an organ, and it rubs up. As much as you're touched and touched, there is still a separation, but a union. He uses a metaphor that our skin interacts with the skin of the world, and so it may be something that has come online metaphorically in my landscape of when we're talking about boundaries in and out or whatever is what is the density? What is the makeup of the boundary? What is the substance kind of that we let's face it, we mentally probably create, but with Doug there, I mean, in his hand, there was no, wall between other than the image in his hand and connected to him. So I just wanted to, you know, bring that forth of listening to how I'm being activated, listening to what we're talking about.
Right. And I'm not an can you hear me okay? I hope I'm not disturbing. Okay. The idea of a limniscate and the idea of a Mobius strip, mm-hmm. and the idea of a Klein bottle. These are all topological shapes, or the torus.
Yeah.
And Merleau-Ponty, and I believe Kearney draws a lot upon the phenomenology of Merleau-Ponty. He would often say, if your right hand touches your left hand, the right hand is the active toucher. The left hand is receiving the touch.
Yeah.
But it's ambiguous.
Yes, right.
There's a great deal of ambiguity because this is all happening within an organism. Now, if I go out and touch your right hand with my left hand or my right hand, if I touch you, mm-hmm. and or you touch me, it's going to be ambiguous about who's the toucher and who's the touched.
Right.
So there's an area of ambiguity. And our language, of course, can reflect this. And I think this kind of complexity. And that's the phenomenological body that he's
talking about. Right.
It's not the same thing as lungs, heart, liver.
No.
Post-production, you know, secretions in the digestive system. That's all important. But that's more like a physiological, biological body. And that's very different from the lived body.
Right.
And I'm embodying something. I use my voice. You use your voice. We use gestures. And we come up with something like a guess about what's going on with the other person.
Well, and that's the sense I get is that if we can accept that there's a hermeneutics, that there's an interpretation and get better at not trying to find one interpretation or an absolute interpretation to actually engage. Kearney's trying to say we need to better engage our senses. Science and certain spiritual traditions have merit in trying to bring forth how our sense of we don't have enough understanding of our senses. You know, and they can delude us. That's true. But I think Kearney's trying to bring, but okay, that's true, but they're still useful. We still need to use them on whether we're in an experience that you've had, you know, on a different plane.
That's
still senses of a different caliber, if I can say.
Subtle senses.
Yeah, and this brings in Kearney's notion of Aristotle saying the interesting thing about touch is there's different kinds of touch.
That's right.
And that's what makes it complex. That's what makes it, there's different kinds, because I feel I've been touched through this medium. I understand the limitations, but I actually could be confused if I was in your space, we were in space, I still could have some confusion.
That's
right. But that's I'm just honoring the fact that I'm being touched through this medium by your words and your expressions and Doug's and Jeffrey's.
I think our alienation is expressed so beautifully. Coleridge says, he's looking at a beautiful sunset. He says, I see, but do not feel how beautiful you are. And I believe that disconnect between the visual and the feeling, the kinesthetic, is a the way that the romantics were rebelling against the Enlightenment. And I think Coleridge really sums up this malaise very beautifully in that description. And I remember, when I remember first reading that, I don't know, when I was at high school, I went, yes, I know exactly how that feels, to see something that's beautiful, but don't feel it.
Yeah.
There's that disconnect. And this is the structure of a phobia. And I think it's pervasive in our culture. We just
and it's parts and whole. It goes with the parts and whole too.
Exactly. But on my fire escape the other day, I have a practice of going out and on my fire escape and reading or just watching the sky and the changing cloud formations and the birds and the trees and everything. Even in a big city like Manhattan, there are still little pockets of, I don't know what you call it, but there are birds and trees and bees and all of that's going on around me. I hesitate to call it nature because that once again slaps a label on it, you know, but it's because it's much more complex than that. But I just saw a cloud formation in the late afternoon, and I just let go of that I see but do not feel. And I just said, what happens if I see and feel the cloud formation?
Right.
And I realized that the shape and the color, which was changing as I watched it, produces a strong feeling state, a psychic state, if you will. So I felt like I was in a communique with this cloud formation. And I think our tendencies, of course, is to label and get a handle on something and then dismiss it rather than stay open to the mutual influence. And I play with the idea that maybe the cloud knows I'm paying attention.
Johnny, that's interesting because that's actually a Vajrayana practice that I've been practicing for over a year of Tibetan Vajrayana. And, you know, it comes from Tibetans living at 15,000 feet. And this one teacher that it's called Eyes Wide Open is where I read this. And I want to get back to I need to digress just a minute of, you didn't, I just need to slow down a little bit. I was going too fast. Sorry. My tongue was trying to outdo my brain. Okay, I'll just finish with this. Anyway, Eyes Wide Open was a Tibetan practice of helping Westerners have a tendency when they see of trying to grasp the tag, grasp. And so they're kind of, from a energetic meditation, your energy is always going out through your eyes. And so the practice is actually to reverse it and feel your eyes receiving rather than grasping, just as an experiment. And you can ever so subtly feel the muscle change, the muscle of your eyes that go out and switch. And he's not saying that you necessarily, it's just to switch up so that you realize that you actually have this dual capacity. But we get addicted or habituated a one way of using a muscle. Which, you know, in muscle work, you always want to go both ways. You know, you want to go this way, you know. And so I was reminded of that in the way you were talking about your experience, Johnny. But the other place I was going to go is one of the things in my early life, many years ago, I was part of community theater. And I was backstage. I had bit parts. I did not want to speak on stage, but I was okay playing a tramp that only did Lucille Ball, Charlie Chaplin, nonverbal kinetics. But one of the things I appreciated in being part of a troupe in community theater is watching my friend who introduced me and other actors take words and enact what the words were trying to indicate. And I think throughout this particular Zoom, and one of the things that I feel that the tension that we need to hold in our bodies literally is the ability to theorize in the sense of having a vision of how something is going or how we're going to do something, and then applying it, then enacting it, bringing it in through and moving it out, and watching how sometimes, and I think this goes back to Bates and I want to tie it back in, is how we've been doing it a certain way and not check in, well, is that the only way to do it? So we've created an addiction or an error. We haven't been open to other ways of doing things, even other ways of observing, new ways to give attention to the act of observing. That's why I really related to Nora's giving the muscle notion of observing, you know, that kinetic. And I just for clarification, John, is that part of the physical body, like organs, or is that phenomenal?
Well, I think it could be both. I think
okay. The
thing about the exercise you described, which I really appreciate your description, how the visual system can, our eyes can be hard or they can be soft.
Yes.
And the muscles around our eyes can be tense or they can relax. And the visual system can do both. And there are times to be able to, need to write, read the fine print in a contract. And then there are times when you can relax the eyes. And then you can get quite immersed in your environment. And the boundaries can soften. And the peripheral is sometimes comes forward. And you can do this on the street when you're walking and doing the shopping or doing regular activities. You can soften. And rather than, as I often do in the big city, where people are trying to grab your place in line, there's a bit of a neuromuscular lock that happens.
Yes.
But if you can be aware of it and have a little bit more mindfulness, you can soften. And then all of a sudden, certain surprises may come. You know, a person often will make a gesture towards you that's very benevolent, as I tried to describe that exchange with a young man, because he noticed my frustration. And because he noticed my frustration, I was less frustrated and I was more generous. And
exactly.
He gave me immediate feedback. Because
shared attention.
That's right. So we started to share attention and have a very enjoyable, informative exchange. And I think these are potentials all over the place. We have these potentials. And so I do believe that if we can soften, and when we get tense and we feel the tension, if we can give our attention to that and just intend for it to relax, it might happen. I also notice that sometimes we do need to intensify.
Yes.
Okay, this intensity, if I soften and relax around this person's intensity, they're going to knock me over.
Right.
All over me. And they'll feel just fine doing that. So I have to match them. I say, this is my space. I plant my feet firmly on the ground. You can't have it. And they'll say, okay, man, chill out, relax.
Yeah.
So that's good for them and good for me, that they know I can make boundaries when I need to. But I don't want to have to be addicted to that as the only way I operate. So I think as we move, as we are, towards, we have 7 billion people on the planet and 2 billion more are expected before we max out. We've had an increase of 6 billion people in the last 100 years.
Right.
And an increase. I think we should expect there to be these kinds of this friction.
Oh, yeah. And we need to hone our skills to work with this change and stuff. I want to add a layer to what you just described, working with it, because you so well described how, as a bouncer, you have to work with intensity like along your way. But one of the things that came online for me is matching their intensity and being agile at the same time. That sometimes, John, and it's not to say that there's a time to stand your ground, but you can also stand your ground. And pardon, I go back to my metaphor, like a keter master that is centered, that goes, oh, I'm going to step out of the way while you fall on your face.
That's true.
And that's not just physical, it's emotional and verbal. You know, and don't get me wrong, it's just something I know that I've been able to work with to help me, because like you, I feel it's necessary. I'll say it for me, but I find familiarity with your notion of intensity and using it. But for me, I want to honor my intensity and be skillful of how it's working in me to keep my center. That's and what keto as a metaphor does is maintaining the center with intensity and being movable, agile, rather than the other martial arts that I don't appreciate is, for my taste, too combative. I go, if I have to go that way, I'm more of a wrestler in close, you know, put you on the ground if I have to. And that goes for whether it's just a physical or a verbal or emotional reaction, you know.
Yes, and I
just wanted to add that layer because I just felt like there's a common ground with both of us working with intensity.
Well, I think there's also attraction. Maybe wrong. I'm sure that Jeffrey and Doug might have a different repertoire, but I'm attracted to the warrior, and I believe you are too. It's a strong draw. It's an archetype that I had to very fully in order to survive. A violent world that I was in and still am in. However, there are other archetypes, and there's the magician, there's the lover,
the healer, there's the trickster. The trickster is much more my interest than the warrior.
I think we've noticed that about you, Jeff. So and we can all have
to come back to a few things. One of the things I wanted to, well, first of all, I wanted to say, Johnny, that you picked up on this gesture of Doug's, but I think actually there are a number of, I wouldn't say always new things, but there are practices in the way we are interacting with each other that are special, I think, for today. Maybe they've been growing over a period of time through the reading and discussing, but there's some changes going on in the way we are interacting with each other that I particularly noticed today compared to earlier times. For instance, just to mention it, because we talked about the senses and the really, like Michael, your senses, meaning and orientation, which I really like. Well, I guess it's from Kearney, there's also this idea of synesthesia. And in the way we talked when we came on this morning, several people were using synesthesia in the way they were talking about the senses. I think I'm going to go back and listen to the recording because I think it was done spontaneously without anybody remarking on it. And yet it was there.
Excellent.
And it's rare that I hear synesthesia in a natural, non-intentional way coming into discussion. And I'm really interested in what's going on there. So I have a sense that our reading, particularly of Nora, have started to change some of our interactions, understandings of things in a visceral body way, rather than only on the intellectual level. And I think this is something interesting that's going on in this discussion. I wanted to come back to, I'm also trying to slow myself down. I love that you stopped, Michael, and you said, oh, I need to, you know, slow down. Because again, this is another these things that I'm talking about. I mean, Johnny, you said the whole discussion is about chunk down and chunk slow. And so we've been trying to incorporate that into our interactions, I think, over, it takes a while to learn it, but I think it's beginning to take hold. And so that's another kind of interaction. We check each other on these things too, which I think is really interesting. But I do want to slow down, but I wanted to come back to the idea of entanglement, because you mentioned it, Michael, because you mentioned this idea of entanglement. Mm-hmm. You said things are entangled. Right. And I spent the week, because I was asked by a friend of mine who is working in the area of cultural exchange, cultural appropriation, academically, and she asked if we could meet so that I could explain to her quantum entanglement, because she wants to apply it in the context of cultural appropriation. I'm not exactly sure how. So I spent a week reading Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen, the original article, then the reply by Boer, and then the articles by Bell, in order to understand, because it's really quite a complex issue, where does it come from, this idea of entanglement, quantum entanglement?
Right.
And a lot of people are interested in it, but it's a very, very nuanced discussion that got us here. So anyway, I was just thinking while I was listening and after you brought up the topic, I thought, well, maybe I could do a cafe on quantum entanglement. I think
that would be good.
That would be fun. We could maybe approach Marco Mazzi and see if he would like to take part in the discussion, because he's also got a really good grounding in quantum physics as well. So, that was an idea. But I just wanted to notice these things we're doing with each other in the way that, Johnny, you noticed what Doug was doing. Because I think attending to these things, so attending rather than paying attention to.
Well, isn't it interesting how, and Nora is very good at pointing this out, I feel, in she actually models this for you, that change, attending to our language and how we're using it, can shift your perspective. You know, and, you know, in terms of entanglement and some of these ideas, I come from a very intuitive place, and the language, to give language to my intuitive understanding, is what's complex to me. Some of these ideas, I just, for some reason, I intuitively just go, well, that makes sense, but trying to express it back out, you know, bring it out, I stumbled.
Because entanglement is an intuitive idea, but the fact that it is built into the structure of the universe in a non-conventional way for us to think about is what's interesting about quantum entanglement as a kind of, so because the idea of entanglement in quantum is not quite the same as the intuitive idea we commonly have. It includes elements that are a bit
special. Oh, thank you for adding that layer, because I was just going to, okay. I thank you for adding that layer. I just know that words can be metaphors for me. So when I hear the word entanglement, because I'm a maintenance worker and I have to work with knots all the time. I've had to work with knots. I've had hands on. When I think of entanglement, I think of knots and untying the knots.
Yeah.
And going through the process of sometimes of being frustrated with a knot and just, okay, I'm just going to cut it, you know, fuck it, you know. But I have grown patience that there's a certain hands-on visceral experience of, you know, untangling the knot, undoing the knot.
Which so takes us back into Bateson's discussion of models, is it? Was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because knots are a kind of model.
Yeah. So, and thank you for bringing that forward of noticing, because I think that's a very, and attending to that, because I think that's something that I've noticed, I've been here about a year and a half, that is kind of peeping its way through. It's coming forward. We're all kind of in different ways noticing that, I think.
I was just gonna jump in there. I think it's maybe it's more important than the intellectual stuff that we talk about. The changes in behavior, in how we do things. Anyway, I just wanted to get that in.
Well, I think William Blake said, "May God keep us from single vision and Newton's sleep." And I know you're interested in doing a study on William Blake. I think that's extremely exciting. Because he was very rare, you find. He was a great poet and a great visual artist. So he combined both in a very unique way. And I just wanted to connect with the word in the belly, part 5 of Samathasi. She's talking about language and prose and how we... She says, to address the depth of these mechanistic habits of thinking is to go downstairs below our verbal conscious awareness, and that requires other language. We treat prose seriously and give it credibility, and consider this form of communication to be rational and precise. Words in prosaic syntax have gravitas in our culture. They appear to offer conceptual stability, but this stability is an impossibility that scientific and non-fictional discourse fail to account for. Science changes all the time. And then she goes on to say, descriptions in this form are still stuffed with metaphors, still wound around invisible narratives. So this reminds me of something that we said earlier about how the mental rational, the theoretic, it rides piggyback upon previous structures like the magical and the mythical. And the theoretic, although it emerges out of the interplay of these previous structures, it can never separate itself from those previous structures. Mm-hmm. So prose and poetry and metaphor are pervasive. And it's amazing how many people are totally unaware of the metaphors that they're using.
Yeah, that's true.
Applied metaphors. I think it's like there's 6 metaphors and almost, you know, the average is 6 metaphors a minute in people's spoken speech. So I think that's a very, very playful aspect of what I've been attempting to do in very, you know, what is that like? How do we translate some of our, when we are at our best, whatever that is, that's like what, is an invitation to go into metaphor. And I believe it really does open us up to some of these invisible narratives that never go away. They're always going on. But I think we can start to appreciate, as Kearney does, the stranger within.
Yeah.
Stranger within me is a stranger within you as well. Rather than scared, oh, this person that I thought I knew so well, I don't know them that well. I want this to stop. I want them to act normal. You know? And I think our relationships are are often made really tense when we try to simplify another person to make myself feel comfortable. Maintain certain stability so that I can feel safe.
Hey, quiet.
We induce a lot of paranoia, unnecessary paranoia in our relationships. Because as other people...
Quiet.
And we use our language in different ways, and we may not have vocabularies yet for these, for the stranger within or the stranger without.
So that promiscuous I again, your promiscuous I.
Well, it's, and that promiscuous I can be a stranger.
It sure can.
And Kearney quotes, I'm sorry, John, to interrupt you.
And that's the new religion.
He made an interesting piece that civilization began when we had to discern of to a stranger extending an open hand or reaching for our gun, our weapon. And, you know, it's interesting that metaphor, that whole thing. When I read it, I was thinking of you pointing out the issue of distrust and trust. How we can trust somebody and end up having to, you know, we end up, there's distrust because of an act that they did. There's distrust, and then distrusting somebody when we should have trusted them, you know, and it's that ambiguity again, that promiscuous, I'm going to add that metaphor, promiscuous. But I do see that's a reality we have to, if I can put it this way, wholeheartedly engage. And I emphasize wholeheartedly because it's only on the feeling level and to what extent, not with absolute certainty, but with at least more confidence of with the feeling of discerning friend or foe, open hand or reach for an Aikido move or whatever, you know. But that's, again, these are taking capacities and abilities that are in us and learning how to work with them. They're there, but we have layers of society notions of, and some of it is just downright demonization of those abilities.
And I'm sorry I also interrupted, Johnny, but I actually felt that I could interrupt because I was interrupting Johnny with Johnny.
That's very good feedback. So, Doug, I haven't heard from you in a while. Are you getting ready to say something?
I'm ready.
Let's have a drum roll here.
So I'm in the library here, and since it's summer, no one comes and cleans up these private rooms. So I guess about 3 weeks ago, I grabbed a couple books on about Blake, and they were sitting in the chair here. I had to go to the bathroom, and I picked up another. I found the Fearful Symmetry. I'm thinking about. I can't check out books here because it's a college.
Yeah, book. That's a good one. It's a really good one.
But it's got a really good quote on the body, and something we've been toggling around, but I don't think we specifically honed in on what we discussed Tuesday or in the Lockman Cafe about the imagination or the imaginal. And at least in this book on page 18 and 19, is it Fry? Yeah, Northrop Fry is talking about Blake's use of the body. And saying Blake means the whole man as an object of perception. So I think this is from the fourth plate in Marriage of Heaven and Hell. It says, man has no body distinct from his soul. For that called body is a portion of a soul discerned by the five senses. But he goes on to talk about how Blake uses the term soul, how... he uses and he talks about the poetic genius is the true man. And the body or outward form of man is derived from the poetic genius. And then Frey goes into saying, well, this is the imagination. This is the use of imagination. And essentially, Blake is using imagination to denote man as an acting and perceiving being. And that is, a man's imagination is his life. It's very interesting, so maybe we'll get into this if we discuss it during the Blake sessions, but I like this one phrase here when talking about kind of the passive imagination, which may go back to kind of that receiving a lecture versus the active mind, the imaginative mind. And he says, the imaginative mind, therefore, is the one which has realized its own freedom and understood that perception is self-development. So that's all I want to read from that. But that's what we've been doing here, and that's what Jeffrey noted, that we've been progressing as floating bodies in cyberspace. We've learned from one another within this conversation. We've learned from this strand of Bateson calls, this reading group, along with the other various circles or non-circles and fields that we've participated in cafes or quantum poetics or whatever it might be. We're some sort of strange body that not necessarily just the four of us here, but those who participated. And we take our separate parts and come back with new information. And it's not something, the framework, the only frame we have is this rectangle. But if we imagine what we have become outside of this mechanical body, where we're some amorphous formation, ever growing, there's this pulsating, I think someone used the term palpable feel to what's going on. And yeah, I can almost grasp it. I like it. And I don't know how all that relates to what we've been talking about, other than it is what we've been talking about.
Well, I love the fact that you brought Blake in, because and we've been talking about other representations than words. So part of the preparation for the Blake, well, because I'm also doing a little bit of a collaboration with somebody on Blake as well, in the academic world. Well, not quite, but anyway. So I've been drawing, I've been using Blake's illustrations as inspiration to draw things, illustrations that are somehow a kind of response to Blake. So you all remember, whoops, hang on, I lost it.
I was going to pull out a smartphone.
Yeah. You all remember that image of Blake's, right? With the...
Yes.
Yes. So I've done that image as a response.
Whoa.
So it's the light coming down into the checkerboard is the world, and the light coming down from above. But in the middle of the light is this crack, you know, this darker thing. So it was partly inspired by Leonard Cohen's line, the crack that lets the light in.
Oh, beautiful.
You know, so, but it's also partly inspired. So I have, it's just the first one, but I have a series of drawings that I've been developing using Blake's own illustrations as a kind of background to switch the dialogue. So it's not just on the level of the words, but also on the level of the images and things. So
you're doing a like a cover of his, you know, like
yeah, cover music. Yeah, exactly.
We're getting about 8 minutes away, and I'm just taking note of that. But before we leave, I would like some feedback from all of you as far as, my presentation and because I'm starting to be more open to asking feedback from people I trust, not just feedback from anybody. Because I feel safe enough that I can ask for feedback of what you guys thought of my slant on the whole thing. Because I haven't been here for the whole thing. So that's one of the reasons I am considering this. You know, I came in.
I thought it was great, Michael. I mean, really, we only need, we kind of need somebody to lead us in.
Okay.
You know, because it's not always easy to try and start the discussion. And so sometimes it can be more structured and sometimes less. It can be inspirational. Doug often does inspirational pieces. But it was perfect to lead us into the discussion today.
I thought
it was very good. Yeah.
Thank you.
I liked
it.
Much. Thank you, Michael. It's a very clear presentation. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Next time, I propose to lead it as the final one for the my turn anyway.
Yeah.
So I will lead the discussion on the final closing.
And then there's a wrap-up too, right?
I think we decided not to do the wrap-up. I think it's all included in the next week. Is that, Doug, is that what we decided? I can't remember now.
Right. And yeah, so we've combined them both into one session just to keep the flow and
because it's not a long piece next week. It's a it's a shorter piece than we had today. So
okay.
And I'm just going to throw out a suggestion. Not that we have to go beyond our time limit, but if we want to meet a little bit earlier, we can do that perhaps. Unless that would be throwing people off, but
you mean today?
Next time.
Oh, do it earlier.
If we want a longer session.
Oh, if we want to do a longer session, I don't have any trouble with a longer session, but.
I don't think you should do it earlier. I can barely make it. But
yeah, it's hard for me too. So yeah. But if we go over the end of the 2 hours, we could probably manage. Maybe aim for two and a half hours if necessary, but only if necessary, something like that.
That seems good.
I've been listening, and I think I posted this, to Gene Seabury and Katie Lang do a version of Calling All Angels.
Yeah.
And New York State has, the Green New Deal is really going to happen. New York State, everyone who does business with New York State is going to have to change how they do business because of this law. And everyone does business in New York State. And also, calling all angels, Hawaii has done this, Washington, California, Colorado, Nevada. And so I think the angels are out there, you know? I love the beautiful word, the names here, Colorado, California, Nevada, Washington, Hawaii. They're just beautiful words. And I know that it's gonna happen in Canada, and it's going to happen in Mexico, and it's going to happen in Hong Kong, and it's happening in Europe. So I believe that I just want to acknowledge this and give attention to this shift that's happening. And that is reported on the front page of the New York Times, the very conservative paper, is extremely significant. So I believe we're doing a good job, guys. I think we, whether we realize it or not, are creating the conditions for these shifts. So we're doing the heavy lifting here, and it doesn't, there are a lot of numbers who are joining us, but I believe there are invisible worlds that are giving attention to our coming together and creating the conditions for this kind of exploration.
Well, and I just want to say this cafe has gotten into my blood so that just like they say, you know, what do you do off the cushion? What do you do off the Zoom? You know, what do you do off? The two worlds interact, and we're having to learn how to interact just like a meditator with the Zoom world, you know. But yeah, this, I've had several feedback from people that go, Michael, something's different of you. And a big component, not the only component, has been this last year and a half of being in this cafe surrounded by people where I can act crazy and weird and have strange ideas and not feel like.
And we love you.
Thank you. I love you too.
We put up with it, Michael. But I think the wonderful thing is that we're doing this in public.
Yes, right.
Instead of having just a private meeting that stays with us, we are taking that risk.
Yes.
It's intimate and it's also public. So I think we're redrawing the map of the public, private.
And in a way, because I said I threw this out as a challenge, we can think about the planet. You know, a 20-year plan for the planet. In a way, that's what we're doing.
Yes.
In a way, without explicitly doing it, implicitly, that's what we've been doing. And in my, you remember my 20-year plans, the whole thing is you have to intend and commit to it. But the world takes care of itself and moves along with you. And this is what we're seeing. This is what you're talking about, Johnny, is that if we hadn't committed to this, maybe this wouldn't have happened in the world because somehow the two go together, right? So
yeah, and I want, Johnny, I want to kind of remodel my image of Hercules with the bridge. Okay, remember that? I don't see myself as Hercules necessarily, but as I just moved beyond Hercules, but I honor the fact that I've been doing a lot of heavy lifting, but that also has been translated into bring it down to just softening and acting rather than. Because with Hercules, you got to get hard.
Well, as a casting director, as I noticed you in your presentation today, and this is my image of you.
Okay. I just,
he would really be good in the role of Friar Lawrence in Romeo and Juliet.
Oh.
He's the counselor.
Oh.
Romeo's counselor, and he also marries Romeo and Juliet. But he's a very philosophical, very... he has a beautiful speech where he's looking at herbs and flowers and it's describing them. So he's a very ecologically aware guy. I'll find the speech and I'll post it. So maybe you
please do. I'd like to read it.
I'd like to hear you recite it because you have a beautiful.
Thank you. And you post it and then I'll practice it and we'll do it one day.
Because I think it's a beautiful text and I would love to cast you in this role.
Oh, thank you.
And you can be Hercules too.
You can
be both, you know?
Yeah.
I have to go, folks. Doug, do you have any final thing that you want to say? Or
yeah, Doug.
I didn't get a chance to say thank you to Michael for the introduction. Great job. We've talked on the side about both of our kind of coming out of our shell or articulating the inarticulate speech of the heart. And
yeah.
Another recognition of that fact that you have changed quite a bit.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll look forward to your Friar Lawrence reading.
Okay. Okay, love you. Love you guys. This has been great.
Okay.
Thank you for giving this. Bye-bye.
My pleasure. Thank you all.
Bye-bye.